Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making us and government more responsible. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free to, from the USA, 877-876-5227, from Canada, 888-810-8322, or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you would be also able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible on the station archive. And you can read my own blog at http://howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com. Now, this week I did not quite finish my blog in time for this show, but check it out next week if you've not yet signed up to get my mailings. The subject is Sons and Daughters of Liberty, Arise and Take Back America. I think you'll like it, especially if you're a member of the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks, or the Redmen. And thanks to Joan for her lovely note on our last show, featuring Bob Petrakis, candidate for governor in Ohio against neocon candidate Ken Blackwell. Also, thanks to Eric, Martha, and Bill for their very good wishes. And now our update from New York and elsewhere. A whimpering but defiant Ada Smith was found guilty of the charge of harassment in New York, bargained down from the original charge of assault against a female office worker she battered last year. The other case of abuse that took place just a few weeks ago is still pending. Smith was sentenced to a fine of $300 and a course in anger management. She's expected to appeal. The Democratic Party in Queens has finally withdrawn all support from Ada Smith's re-election campaign. That campaign will pit Smith against a popular local organizer this November. Inquiries continue related to the Smith case and the non-investigation by the Ethics Committee of the state legislature, headed by Senator Patterson. We will provide you with updates on that, which promises to become a new investigation that will delve deeper into the non-ethics of the New York legislature as a whole. Lots of fun and games in the offing. And now, if you are not following the ongoing expose on the cabal surrounding the persons of Edward H. Crane III and Howie Rich and their longtime friends, you can do so by going to http://www.hartwilliams.com. Hart Williams, a longtime journalist living in Oregon, became annoyed earlier this year at a steady stream of AstroTurf initiatives that have cost Oregonians money and opened up development in ways that destroy the quality of life there. Hart Williams started to wonder where the money was coming from and found out that it was being channeled through the cookie-cutter organizations spawned by the cadre of individuals around Edward H. Crane III and Howie Rich. The two men have known each other since the mid-70s, when they were living out those first heady years of Libertarian Party organizing, and Crane was living out the first chapter of his power fantasies. Along with those fantasies came ideas about how one could augment income while destroying local government infrastructure and ensuring that local people are never entrusted with governing themselves. At least that was the experience of those who worked with Crane and the Libertarian Party. Crane and Howie saw a way to make that work for them. So, a in 1992, they launched their first initiative, U.S. Term Limits. It's a long story with lots of players, but they all go back to 1979. Read the latest chapter and early chapters on the Williams site. We will supply updates as they come out. This and other stories will be covered in my book, Politics for the Politically Clueless, out as soon as I finish it. Stay tuned for more. And our thought for the week ahead. This week on The Spiritual Politician, we're going to be hearing about fusion as an approach to our traditional spiritual practices. I'm sure you have noticed that religion has caused a lot of disagreements throughout history. There have been crusades, there have been holy wars. There's so many different conflicts that have taken place because of religion. Wars have been fought over either religion or by using religions to justify war so many times, it's hard to keep track. Today, many sects in America are actually urging war in Israel in the belief that this will hasten what they hope will be the second coming of Christ. Now, I happen to disagree with their theology. In fact, what they refer to is very recent and comes from the Scofield Bible, which was an interpretation of the original dating from the late 1900s. And if you read over what they expect to happen, it sounds more like science fiction than theology. But the thing that struck me when I read about their expectations was this. Those believers don't think they need to be responsible for the way they want government used. They expect that if they are saved, they can put everything else in the back burner, make sure their rapture robe is ready, and just enjoy themselves. At the same time, they evidently have no problem watching the government that they voted into office carry out policy that is murdering thousands in the Middle East and Americans who trusted their country and went to serve. They believe that this administration is just carrying out the work of God by making sure that Armageddon comes as soon as possible. And that leads to the question of what Armageddon is. If you go into a bookstore or online, you will rapidly discover that Armageddon is open to more interpretations than you could possibly imagine. There's no agreement, and most Americans do not realize why this relative minority is urging war. Many of those interpretations are contradictory, and the people who believe in one interpretation are often ready to duke it out with those holding other interpretations. And while many rapture-ready folks are happy to see government take action, they hope we'll bring it on, they also believe that they are not then responsible for any mistakes. Evidently, they never consider the possibility they might be wrong and that their actions might have caused the death of millions of innocents. I heard a story the other day that went like this. Two men met in Jerusalem. They were both Americans, and as they talked, they discovered that they had a lot in common. They both came from towns in Georgia, located just 5 miles apart. Each had come over to visit the Holy Land as something they had always wanted to do, and they'd come with their churches. Each was a member of various lodges and organizations in their local town. Each made his living in the construction business, one building homes and the other commercial units. They were delighted to discover that they were both deacons in the same Church of Christ Covenant Southern Synod. They shook hands, and the older man said, "I guess you all practice the new revised apostolic practices for the renunciation of sin rampant then, right?" And he looked expectantly at his new friend and brother. A look of consternation on the younger man's face erupted into "heretic" as he leapt from the table, smashing his Bible over the older man's head. You see, the younger man's church still used the original new revised apostolic practices for the renunciation of sin rampant. Needless to say, World War III was barely avoided, along with a renewal of a conflict that could have made the Hatfield and the McCoy dispute seem minor. So, why is it that people use religion as a way to divide themselves from each other? There are very few things that all people over time and through all cultures have in common. But one of those things is a sense of connection to the sacred, however they express that. It's Three religions among all of those held by humankind refer to the same sacred texts. Those are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Who today is fighting about which version of the truth will prevail? We all know the answer to that question. The idea of fusion practice is about bringing together instead of dividing, finding common hope and truth instead of allowing differences to draw us apart. Our guest tonight has been thinking about this issue for a long time. He studied the Bible and many other sacred books. He's practiced as a Jew, a Christian, and he's studied the Quran. And in all of these, he's found more to unite than to divide. In addition, he has reached out into life as a secular person, looking for ways to live that send the message of sacred practice into life through action. Greg Johnson works and teaches at the University of Iowa and is the founder of Resources for Life. He has insights worth sharing. Tonight, he's going to share that life journey with us. Please welcome Greg Johnson. Greg, are you there?
I'm here, Melinda. Thank you.
I am so glad that you could be with us tonight. And one of the things that we always talk about first is we ask our guests to tell us something about themselves. So tell us something about Greg Johnson, about your family, your motives, and what matters to you.
Well, I think for most people, it's our early childhood, you know, as we're growing up, the influences that we have at that time, whether it be parents or teachers or the environment around us. And for me, I think that was true. When I was younger, my first introduction to anything religious was attending a school in the Washington, D.C. area.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you grew up, isn't it?
Right. I grew up in D.C. And I went to this Quaker school called Sidwell Friends. And my family had not introduced me to religion formally. They believed that it was up to children to kind of learn about different religions and see what path made most sense to them. And that was fine for me. I didn't have any sense of, you know, pointlessness or wandering. I sort of embraced the wonder of it. And just as you might explore on a trail in the wilderness, different flowers and trees and things like that, I was free to appreciate the various religions and faiths that I saw around me without being forced to, at too early of an age, you know, adopt one without understanding it first.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a respectful and mature way of allowing myself, I guess, because of my parents' leading, to grow into an understanding of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I guess, as a young person, I was influenced back in the 70s, as I was becoming a young teen. My dad was quite involved with public interest work, and at that time, being in the D.C. area, you know, was working with Ralph Nader and some other people concerned with both political and consumer advocacy issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I've said so far, just the aspect of having an openness about other people's beliefs and considering it to be the norm that one would have their thoughts turned to public interest work and seeking ways to have a positive impact on, you know, one's own life, friends, family, community, that was how I was introduced to this planet, you know,
mm-hmm.
as a child. So that's all I knew. And those were the early years, you know, growing up.
And so it seemed like a very natural thing for you to look at your faith as also a fusion?
Yeah, I think because although we didn't religiously attend any congregation, my family's background was Unitarian.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Unitarian faith, for those that aren't familiar with it, it's sort of like the United Nations of religions.
Mm-hmm.
People coming together respectfully under one roof, understanding that no two people, like the funny story you told earlier, you know, no two people are going to think identically the same, even those within the most sectarian fundamentalist congregation of, you know, Christianity or Judaism or Islam, you know, are not going to think exactly the same because our experiences are different.
Mm-hmm.
and we're creative beings, you know. We have different understandings. In fact, I'm not going to agree with my beliefs that I might have a week from now. You know, hopefully I'll grow. Hopefully I'll gain a broader understanding.
That's one of the things that life brings us. It gives us new perspective.
Yeah. So if we can't agree with our own perspective of a year ago or 10 years ago, if we recognize that even we are changing, we really have to then accept the fact that people around us are going to be different than we are as
mm-hmm.
well. And not be so dogmatic because, you know, if we listen to the person we are today 10 years from now, you know, we'll think, wow, how did I think I was so right, you know?
That's very much a young person's attitude, that they think they have all the answers when they
yeah.
don't even realize that they don't even know the questions yet.
Mm-hmm.
So your own faith journey, though, has taken you through the Bible and through Judaism and through the Quran and the work of Islam.
Right. And I was so thankful that I had a chance to really mature as an adult, and it was in my college years then that I really did begin pursuing an understanding of religion. And at that time, what was popular on the campus where I was at the University of Iowa, there were quite a few different evangelical, charismatic type groups that would go out on campuses, you know, like Crusade for Christ and that type of thing,
mm-hmm.
the Campus Crusade for Christ. And so that sparked my interest. I didn't quite want to get involved with the whole drug scene or, you know, fraternities and binge drinking. I didn't think that was going to be a lot of fun. And these religious people, I mean, had they been Mennonites or anything else, I would have been equally interested. But, you know, these religious people seem to be able to laugh and have fun and enjoy life without drugs and cigarettes and alcohol, which didn't seem like, you know, a smart thing to be consuming to me. So I sort of felt an immediate draw to be involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at the time I wasn't really communicating with my parents much, not intentionally. I just, you know, you hang out with your parents and sometimes you don't mention all the details. And then I remember one day I mentioned to my dad that I was getting involved with this local Christian group, and he was, I could tell, you know, a little upset, and he'd never been controlling in any way. I mean, he wanted me to explore life on my own with some independence, but he said, you know, that group, they believe that they believe in the virgin birth. They believe a lot of things that aren't scientifically provable. You know, it's not rational thinking. And he sort of felt that, at least my recollection of it, was that, you know, he felt I was getting involved with a cult when I was getting, you know, this interest in Christianity.
Uh-huh.
Because it wasn't really based on science, and it was a departure from, you know, my Unitarian upbringing. But he let me continue down the path and explore it, and I appreciate that because in retrospect it was a life-expanding experience. And for about 10 years then, I was pretty heavily involved in Christianity, and in a variety of forms of Christianity. My most regular attendance initially was with a Catholic church in town,
mm-hmm.
and then that switched into more of a charismatic Pentecostal type of attendance. But, you know, over the years it's been Methodist and some Baptist experience, and really having an appreciation of all those different representations of Christianity. And I found that it was better, rather than just reading a book about the faith, to really become immersed in it and
mm-hmm.
adopt it as my own and understand it from that perspective. Because it's hard to connect with the people unless you become the people, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you found a lot of common threads through all of these different Christian faiths.
Yeah, I really did. You know, and I found, as enthusiastic as I was about the you know, charismatic groups, for example, I really liked the music, I liked the energy of the meetings and that type of thing. There were some things I found in the Catholic meetings that, you know, just were not present in the Pentecostal meetings. So
mm-hmm.
I found that by going, yes, you know, from even on a weekend, there were times when I would go to maybe three different churches, just out of the curiosity to see how the different people worship.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my introduction to what many Christian friends at the time said was very radical. They said, you know, the E-Free Church is very different than what we believe and practice here. And you know, it's a little bit sacrilegious for you to go over there and talk to the E-Free people because, you know, back in the 18-whatever, you know, they had a split from this church. And then, you know, but I went ahead and did it anyway. And interestingly, of the congregations I went to visit, quite often the pastor would say, you know, I had a sermon written up, but I really feel God wants me to speak about this particular issue and use these scriptures, and et cetera. And there were a number of times when I would go from church to church, and the pastor would say kind of the same thing and would even maybe refer to the same scriptures that, you know, they were saying they wanted to speak what the Holy Spirit was giving them to say. So I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, that God was somehow speaking the same message through these different churches.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, people don't know that. I mean, they don't. The pastor doesn't go to the church down the street the next weekend. You know, you kind of get cloistered into your own little group, and you really don't know what's going on in any other group.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun to pan the camera a little bit, you know, in my own life, zoom out a little, and see what was really going on
mm-hmm.
there.
And you did that. What you did was you were able to look at them like leaves in a book, but you were able to see all of them because you did this in a fairly short period of time.
Yeah.
And you saw the common threads. And what do you think the impact would have been if the other people who were attending the church, let's say several from each church, had done the same thing with you? Do you think that I might have had a different view of the people who were worshiping in other churches?
I guess I didn't understand your question.
Let's say at the time, several of those people that you were around you in the churches, you'd come together and said, let's do this. Let's go from church to church to church and see what things we have in common.
Oh, that happened, actually.
Oh, it did. Tell
yeah.
us about that.
There were some people who were interested in this as well. They became ridiculed by the local churches, and there was a name given to them, and they were called church hoppers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the church hoppers, and there was kind of a group of them, were considered to be not very faithful and to, you know, beware of the church hoppers and uncommitted, sort of fickle. And I think there was a certain, you know, some of the pastors would feel sort of threatened by these church hoppers
mm-hmm.
because maybe the church hoppers would come and take away some of the sheep, you know, or cause some people to go to another congregation. So you'd lose your market share. I think more so today, you know, pastors think in terms of how you look at the marketplace and customers and, you know, market share and that type of thing. So they would worry about losing their market share. But nonetheless, the church hoppers were quite happy to, you know, go see what, in their perspective, you know, what God was doing in these different places. And it was quite enthusiastic. And then interestingly, later in the 80s, and then, you know, on into the 90s, this movement grew up that was called Promise Keepers. I don't know if you ever heard of this.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and then, you know, mixed reviews. I'm sure there's some people that really didn't like the Promise Keepers movement. Those that are, you know, within the church and those without it, outside of the church didn't like the Promise Keepers movement, and some did. But what happened there that was interesting was people from all different denominations were suddenly coming together in stadiums. You know, there would be 50,000 people coming together and singing the same songs and realizing, how is this? It was like, I think a lot of people that were in, you know, tears at these meetings were trying to understand, how can this be? Are we all worshiping the same God? And, you know, we're listening to somebody speak to us. How can we sit here and do this? We never were able to do this before. So those were interesting meetings. I actually went to a few of those. So as I had these experiences, I began to believe in the possibility that there could be some interfaith dialogue and interfaith cooperation and worship, you know. At least to me, I thought, well, at least within the Christian context. I didn't think it could go beyond that. But it seemed hopeful. And then even today now, there are some churches that continue to have joint meetings, but maybe once a month or once every couple of months, the congregations will come together and they'll have a worship meeting or a conference or something.
And so they've found real value in that.
Yeah, very much so. It's really enriching. And it's not threatening anymore. You know, the pastors don't worry, oh, I'm going to lose some of my congregation or something. They don't care. They just want people to be empowered, and they realize that it's, you know, cooperation produces better results than competition,
mm-hmm.
Which is Stephen Covey speaks about that in his Seven Habits, you know, that although we've been brought up to believe, you know, competition in the marketplace is the best thing, and we can't share ideas, and we need to be secretive, but really it's when we cooperate with one another, that's when humanity advances.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the same is true within faith. As we inspire one another and cooperate and try to have respect and seek out common ground, that we move forward.
Well, that's a wonderful story. So, you know, people start talking. Let's go into the promise keepers, because you're right, there's been a real mixed reaction to those in our culture. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is the simple act of having that many people come together and worship at one time gave them an insight into what it was that their act meant, the worship meant.
Yeah.
It was also very valuable because it was teaching them about themselves and about their relationship with the other people in the stadium.
Mm-hmm. And for the...
They weren't alien. They were the same.
Yeah, I guess it removed the... You know how each church has its own little branding?
Yes.
Kind of like a corporate branding or a logo or a... You know, whether it's a flame and a little cross or a, you know, the cross with a circle or the lamb with the dove or the, you know, each church has its own kind of corporate logo thing. And so, but then they had the religious part of the Christianity. They had the religion sort of taken away, the packaging, the marketing of it, taken away. The box was taken away. All there was the product, which they hadn't really focused on before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up until that point, it had been the presentation of the product, the pastor introducing the product. But now it was just them and other children of God and these songs and worshiping and nothing familiar, you know, no familiar church building. There wasn't the parking lot. There wasn't the, you know, reminder about the dispute over, well, were we going to have a volleyball net or were they going to, you know, put in a baseball diamond? And, you know, all that was gone, and they were just sitting there just before God and worshiping. So it's really kind of a special thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like one of the other things that was probably present, and they had lost the box that they were used to, and so they were able to see a different context for their worship. That's really what you're saying, isn't it? And
yeah.
Their relationship with all of those people was therefore different. Instead of being limited, it was unlimited.
Yes, and, you know, when Paul refers to the church, he's not talking about a building. He's talking about some people, you
yeah.
know? And so he would talk about the church that meets at somebody's house. So he's talking about the group, the people that meet at somebody's house.
Mm-hmm.
But today when we think of church, we think of a church building.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's just how we live. We go to the church building, and then we leave the church. And the church isn't a person or people. It's just this building. But in the early Jewish experience for the Israelites, there was quite a bit of time when they were traveling through the wilderness, you know, and they would set up a tabernacle and they would worship in the wilderness. And so they had that reoccurring reminder that faith and religion and spirituality wasn't about the structure or, you know, some, you know, corporate logo or something. It was
yeah.
just put up a tent where there's sand and just start worshiping. So I think some of what we've added on in recent years is sort of superfluous to what was originally experienced and intended
mm-hmm.
By the early believers in God, you know.
Yes, and you started actually learning to practice as a Jew, too.
That was interesting how that took place. And actually, you're out in California? Is
yes.
it San Francisco?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I think that is the headquarters for Jews for Jesus, if I recall. But I became familiar with the Jews for Jesus organization, and I know that there's some Christians who view Jews for Jesus as kind of a plot to, you know, an organization that's going to try to convert Christians to Judaism, maybe, you know,
mm-hmm.
where, and Jewish people view Jews for Jesus as this organization that's going to try to convert Jews to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of criticized from both sides because they're viewed as, well, they're not really Jewish and they're not really Christian, you know. But I was fascinated by some of the materials that were coming out of that river of thought. And essentially the message was that in order to return to some authenticity and really experience the fullness of worship and religious life, that Christians could benefit by embracing Jewish thought and worship and understanding. And that made sense to me. I didn't find anything in the New Testament. There wasn't anywhere where, you know, Jesus said, and turn from Judaism, or, you know, I mean, Paul or anyone else, nobody was talking about, they were all Jews anyway, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Jesus was.
Yeah, in fact, I have what is almost meant to be kind of a humorous web page, but it's also serious, and the web page is called Jesus for Judaism, and it's on the resourcesforlife.com website, and it explores the extent to which Jesus really was Jewish, and that's what he lived and preached, and we're told in the New Testament that many people converted to Judaism in the process of following Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I just for the fun of it, I put together a little table. The title of the table is, What Would Jesus Do? You know, because there's this popular armband you can get, or I don't know, logo that you put on your hat or whatever, WWJD. And so there's this little chart or table, and it shows a number of different customs or traditions that Jesus held to, like recognizing Shabbat or, you know, observing Simcha Torah or Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, you know, these different standard festivals. And his message, which was so central to his life, which was that of Earth increasingly becoming a better place as people would allow their lives to be transformed by God.
Yes.
And ultimately, according to Jesus, which, you know, if we're going to accept what he's teaching and living and preaching, he believed that, you know, the kingdom of God would come here on earth. That was, you know, the prayer that he prayed, thy will be done, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. So he never really preached anything about, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
That wasn't his message. So all of those different things, you know, he didn't eat pork, he didn't think Sunday was Saturday, you know, that was Jesus. And if you look at present-day Jews, interestingly, they hold to all the same practices that he was holding to.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, present-day Christians represent a radical departure from what he was teaching and living. So I find that interesting.
Mm-hmm. That is very interesting. And so in creating for yourself a fusion faith, what you were doing was adding things on. You were trying to understand Christ through walking in Christ's footsteps, right? And
yeah.
Him.
Yeah. And I realized, you know, there's a gospel about Jesus. That's, you know, you and I talking about Jesus and have you met Jesus and are you saved and all of that. That tends to be today's gospel about Jesus. But then there was something that's referred to as the gospel of Jesus.
Uh-huh.
That was the gospel that he preached. He obviously didn't preach about himself. He had a gospel. And his gospel was about the kingdom of heaven coming to earth.
Mm-hmm.
That was his gospel. So, and interestingly, that message is continued to be preached in synagogues today. It was really a Jewish message that he was preaching, and it still is a Jewish message. Even the Shema, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Echad, you know, God is one, worship the Lord thy God with all your heart. That is something that Jesus said was the most central, you know, teaching.
Mm-hmm. You were supposed to worship Christ and worship God with all of your heart, your soul, and your mind. So it's every
right.
part of yourself, right?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I just, as I then began understanding this way of looking at Jesus as a Jewish person, and however you want to view him, I mean, he, Jewish person or son of God or the Lamb of God or the Messiah or whatever you might think he is or was or is going to be, he's still Jewish, you know?
Yes.
So, So anyway, that I think influenced my thinking. And at the time, I was really spending, I was actually doing quite a bit of work with some messianic evangelical Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember having a talk with a woman I was working with, and she said, yeah, it's too bad all those Jews are going to hell. And I said, well, are you serious? Do you think they're really going? I mean, they're living exactly how Jesus lived. And she said, oh, but they haven't said the prayer of salvation. And, you know, meanwhile, I saw around me a lot of contradictions and people who'd said that little prayer but who were, you know, doing a lot of things they shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how is it that these people who are living the way Jesus lived, today they're living that way, that they wouldn't get to heaven, and yet somebody who's not living the way they should be is going to get to heaven? I don't know. It just didn't make sense to me. And I remember reading one of the books that was used, sort of a propaganda material that was used to try to persuade Jews to convert to Christianity. And in that book, this person, the summary of the entire book was basically this Orthodox Jewish person was miserable when he was Jewish, and once he converted to Christianity, then he was happy. And that he thinks everybody's going to be happy if they'll convert to Christianity, and Judaism is just the wrong path for everyone. And as I found that book, I had not seen that, you know, until that day that I found it, and I started reading through it, and it just startled me, and I thought, you know, I don't want to be a part of something that's trying to erode Jewish community, or it's not honest.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I really made a shift to pursuing Judaism more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see any contradiction there. I mean, I still felt that I was being a Christian. I mean, what's more Christian than following the faith of Jesus, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did that for a number of years. And it was really up until 2001 in the spring that I had such an enthusiasm about Judaism, but I've never really spent much time pursuing Islam. And I noticed in the spring of 2001 there seemed to be kind of a turning tide of anti-Arab and anti-Muslim sentiments. And I didn't know, I felt uncomfortable with it because I'm sensitive to kind of what's around me.
Mm-hmm.
But I quickly had a sense that the antidote for that, or at least the way to protect myself from becoming deceived by those misguided sentiments, was to immerse myself in Islam and understand Islam in the same way that I had come to appreciate and understand Christianity and Judaism.
And with Judaism, what you had done is you had found the sort of fusion points between them so that one supported the other.
Right, right. And there were times when I would go to these messianic congregations, which were quite amazing to me. I didn't realize that they had existed. And I went and people would be, you know, speaking in Hebrew and wearing yarmulkes and, you know, going to Torah class and stuff. And then they would start singing these songs that were within the same kind of genre of music as the Christian, you know, contemporary worship songs.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about a lot of what Jesus lived and taught and preached, so they were very much aware of and respectful of Jesus, which I haven't seen that in a synagogue before, but at the same time, they were studying Hebrew and wanting to learn, you know, the Old Testament, the Torah and the Tanakh in the original Hebrew. So I thought, well, this is weird. This is like being in a synagogue and in a church at the same time. But it was consistent with the New Testament. I mean, that's where, you know, Paul said, when he was initially trying to persecute Christians, we read that Paul went to the synagogues.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he went to persecute the Christians, because that's where the Christians went. That there wasn't a division at that time.
Well, Christianity was at that point a fusion.
Right,
you
right.
You had Jews who were understanding their Jewishness through their worship of Christ and his works.
Right. So, then, in 2001, I began going regularly to mosque and trying to help out and volunteering and that type of thing. And that was a good experience. And it actually expanded my understanding of Christianity and Judaism a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in reading the Quran, I was kind of surprised to see that, you know, there's some passages in the Quran that are quite positive toward the Jews and toward Christianity and admonishing people of different faiths to accept one another. I mean, in many ways, the Quran, certainly not in every portion of it, but in large measure, sounds very much like, you know, a guidebook for Unitarians.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah. Here's one, for example, and this is from chapter 2 in the Quran, referring in this case to the Jews. It says, O ye children of Israel, and this is not understood to be the author writing the book, but this is more like God speaking. O ye children of Israel, remember my favors, which I have favored you with. Fulfill my covenant, and I will fulfill your covenant. Me, therefore, dread. Believe in what I have revealed, confirming that ye possess already, and not be the first to disbelieve in it. And do not barter my signs for a little price. And mm-hmm. You know, so it goes on to talk about they have received scriptures that are to be followed, you know, and so that they're not following a false doctrine in a sense, you know. And it's understood, I mean, their hadiths, their teachings about the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that describe how the Prophet would protect Jews.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite different than what we're seeing today. But, you know, that's what was happening in the days at the inception of Islam.
Well, how, I don't know that it's necessarily any different. We have individuals practicing a religion today. We have Christians practicing a religion. We have Jews practicing a religion. They're each of them different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's...
They don't define a religion. That's
right.
A body of belief that sort of reaches beyond them. It's just that everybody practicing is part of that belief.
Collectively.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you, there were a lot of similarities in the ritual that surprised you. Isn't that the case?
Right. I pay close attention in the Orthodox meetings to, in the Jewish congregation, to what specifically was done. You know, you wash your hands before saying the prayer, and sort of the hand washing and the prayers go together at the time before eating bread and that type of thing. And you wash your right hand and then the left hand. And this, of course, is part of the dua in Islam. You're supposed to wash your right hand and your left hand, and that's part of a washing your body, essentially, your mouth, your nose, your head, your ears, that type of thing. But I saw some of these washings being similar. And during the prayer in mosque, toward the end, you turn your head to the right and you speak peace to the person on your right, or you speak peace to the right, and then you turn to the left and you speak peace. And this is also done in the Orthodox congregations in Judaism. You turn your head to the right, you speak peace. You turn your head to the left, you speak peace. In the synagogue and also in the mosque, there would be a box in the entryway. In Hebrew, it's tzedakah, which is charity, and in Arabic, it's zakat, which is charity. So, you know, it's like really the only difference is their language, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
People get hung up on the language. I mean, if you say Allah and I say God and somebody else says, you know, Hashem, then it sounds like we're worshiping different, you know, gods. But when you start talking about, well, what's the nature of this God? And, well, you know, this God is the God of Abraham. Well, wait a minute, that sounds like my God. Well, oh, well, maybe this is the same God, you know. So just giving a different name to God doesn't make God different, you know. If
mm-hmm.
you're referring to the God that Abraham experienced, then I think we're talking about the same God. And interestingly,
go ahead.
Oh, just along those lines, in the Quran, it said that it's permissible for Muslims to marry Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It's permissible for Muslims. You're supposed to observe very strict kosher laws. Halal foods are supposed to be eaten if you're going to be very observant in Islam. And it says, but you can also eat Jewish kosher foods because, you know, their laws are just the same as our laws. So there's an understanding in the sacred text. I'm not talking about some, you know, there are people today, or Shadmanji, or different people who are preaching a more progressive Islam, and that's one thing. But I'm talking about within the Quran from 1,500 years ago, it's already in there that it says we're supposed to get along with one another, we're supposed to respect one another, we can marry each other, we can eat each other's food, and the differences are pretty slight. And someone once said, you know, we should major on the majors and minor on the minors.
Yes.
I think that, yeah.
Yes, and you actually found a lot of similarity when you sort of crossed over and started taking a look at other non-Christian, non-Jewish, non-Islam religions, right? You saw, you know, things that were very resonant from Buddhist thought, for instance.
Right, and it seemed to me that much of what Paul was teaching fascinated me about dying to oneself. I mean, I've had detachment with regard to, okay, I'll give up my TV set or I'll fast for a while. But this Christian concept of giving up your life, you know, dying to oneself, that's like detachment from everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that intrigued me. But I wanted to learn more about, well, what was this detachment that Paul was talking about. So I did study Buddhism a bit. And it's not surprising that there are a number of books. Thich Nhat Hanh has written Living Buddha, Living Christ. There's also Going Home, Jesus and Buddha as Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of thoughtful texts that have been written about these similarities between the lives of Jesus and Buddha. And so, yeah, I found that contrary to what I was being told as an early Christian believer back in you know, the first days when I was converted, essentially, that the other religions, the other congregations, the other denominations were not threats at all.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, going to a mosque or a synagogue was just going to, at least in my experience, it expanded my faith and expanded my appreciation and made me realize, oh, okay, we're not just, you know, in a little island over here, but that other people have a similar belief and interpretation of how God wants us to live.
Mm-hmm. It seemed like a different room in the same house, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
With many, many things in common, the common foundation, and in the things that we use. We reference the things that we sense spiritually through words, but it could simply be just that, a different interpretation of the same thing that we touch with our spirit.
Right. Well, toward the end of these now almost 20 or more years of exploring the landscape of religion and benefiting from the fruit that grows in those different areas and enjoying that, I've wanted to kind of return to rationalism and secularism.
Mm-hmm.
Without any animosity toward religion, I want to continue to have a good relationship with my Orthodox rabbi. And I want to see that my life continues to be, even as a secular humanist who's just pursuing, you know, a better life for humanity, that type of thing, I want it to be consistent. So I'm not going to eat ham.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to mix meat and milk. I'm going to be observing simultaneously Christianity, Judaism, and Islam as best I can, the strictest levels, and yet being secular,
mm-hmm.
living the life of a Muslim, a Jew, and a Christian, sort of like Gandhi did. Gandhi said he was a Muslim, a Jew, and a Christian, you know?
That's right, he did.
And it's possible. And I had fun with my rabbi talking about this. He said, well, you know, you can't turn your lights on the Shabbat, you know, after sundown Friday night. And I said, why not? You know, I just took my electricity out of my house, so I don't think that's going to be a problem. And he said, well, you can't mix milk and meat. And I said, well, I'm going to be a vegan. I'm not going to eat milk or meat. Oh, well, that's okay. So, well, you can't drive your car on Shabbat. You're not supposed to drive your car. I said, on Earth Day last year, I took my car to the junkyard. So I said, I'm not going to drive my car on Shabbat. You know, so he's happy. He's happy. And my Muslim friends, they believe, they accept the fact that I'm a Muslim, that I'm living a good Muslim life. So that's the point where I've wanted to get to, I think, is living a life as a secularist now, but still having some appreciation for and respect for Christianity and Judaism and Islam, and having that respect going both ways. And
well, it
hopefully
sounds like one of the things that's happening there is you're living out the actions of each of those religions simultaneously within the context of your life, without necessarily having to enunciate the words or go to the meetings.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's, I try to do that. Sometimes I'll quote scriptures without actually mentioning the book and verse, you know. I'll just say, oh, someone once said, you know, and I won't offend people that way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can live a religious life without making it look religious, you know.
Yes, and you live in a very interesting place. you've chosen to live in a little house that's 7 feet by 10 feet, and you call it the Hermitage, don't you?
Right, and it's sort of a play on words. I mean, it's called the Mobile Hermitage, and you know, as if I'm this hermit, but at the same time wanting to get out and around and visit with people. And for those who are listening, I haven't really mentioned my website very much, but I should, out of courtesy, for those that want to learn more about the little house or some of these other things.
Mm-hmm, please do.
But it's resourcesforlife.com, and that's resources for life all spelled out. And listeners can also go to smallhousesociety.org to learn more about this whole small house movement. But, you know, I found that there's quite a bit of peace and effective living that can be found through a very minimalistic approach to life, you know, getting rid of a lot of possessions.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like I was saying, you know, this promise keeper's experience of removing the religion and all you have left is God, or the Israelis, the early Jews, you know, going through the desert and all they had was some little tent in their worship. You know, when you remove the clutter and the materialism from life, you're kind of left with yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you're left with God and you're left with the universe and those you love. And but that's all that's there. The materialism, the clutter, the superfluous junk has been removed.
Mm-hmm. The distractions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, of course, one of the things that historically over time, people who want to, they become hermits, they become nuns, they want to focus on the spiritual aspect of their life. They eliminate the things, the clutter that cause the noise that keeps them from hearing, you know, the substance of their faith.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that it has in common. So really, you, even though in some ways you seem to have eliminated those things in your life for the moment, they're still really very much present.
Yeah, I guess to a large extent, I try to let people know that although my life at home is quite simple, I live very much like an Amish person. You know, there's no electricity to speak of, and there's no running water. I carry the water to my house. When I get to work, I'm working with, you know, some of the most advanced technology available today. I do some work with the University of Iowa and in the area of computer support. And so
mm-hmm.
It gives me kind of a retreat. I've observed how when people go on vacation, they want to be in a little cottage or cabin off in the woods and live a rustic life because they find that to be nurturing.
And you have that all the time.
Yeah, I thought, why not, you know, if that's what we do on vacation, why not just live that way all the time?
Well,
so,
I have to agree with you. And thank you for being with us, Greg.
You're
this
welcome.
This has been just wonderful. Thank you for sharing your views on your fusion faith and your life journey. And
thank you.
And could you just once more give our listeners your contact information so they can go to your site?
Sure. It's www.resourcesforlife.com. And they can find all of my contact information there.
Thank you. You take care and you have a wonderful Labor Day weekend.
Thanks, Melinda. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
And that's our show for today, Friday, September 1st, 2006. You have a wonderful Labor Day, too. Be safe and happy together. Here at The Spiritual Politician, we're working to help individuals find ways to unify our spiritual natures with the material world in which we live. Government is a tool we've all mandated to handle a portion of our lives, but it remains up to us to make sure it's used appropriately. The people should use persuasion, never deceit, coercion, or violence in every relationship, including those we delegate to government. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. This remains where we want to go today. It's up to each of us to ensure we reach that destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.